Today, which are the best and worst states for religious liberty? We'll hear about the 2024 Religious Liberty in the States report with Dr. Mark David Hall.
Fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court is getting a lot better on religious liberty, so that's nice to see. But again, there's still lots of room in which states can act or choose not to act, and so we're trying to shine a light on where states can act.
Then we'll talk about the good and not so good science behind the climate change movement with Dr. Calvin Beisner.
So we're clearly seeing an effort to make older temperatures look lower, newer temperatures look higher, to increase the apparent rapidity of the warming.
It's the weekend of September 21st and 22nd. I'm Jeff Chambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Religious liberty, or freedom of conscience, is one of the great achievements in the American experiment in self-government. How does your state rank when it comes to laws protecting religious liberty? Well, now you can find out. The Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy and its parent organization, First Liberty Institute, has just released its 2024 report on religious liberty in the states. Joining us is Dr. Mark David Hall, Director of Religious Liberty in the States, Senior Research Fellow with the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, and Professor in Regent University's Robertson School of Government. Dr. Hall, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us the purpose behind this report. I know it's in its third year. What is the intent in getting this report out?
Sure. So when Americans think about religious liberty, I think we immediately go to the First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or in some cases, federal legislation. Now, these are very, very important protections, but there are still many ways in which states are free to protect religious liberty, or they could choose not to protect religious liberty. So in other words, the First Amendment or federal law doesn't cover these things. And so what we do is we look at 39 distinct ways that states can choose to protect religious liberty or not. Some of these overlap in various ways, and so we collapse these into 16 safeguards. And then because we're Americans, we measure how well each state does, and we rank the states number 1 to number 50.
Okay. Now, this is covering all beliefs, not just Christianity, correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, some of them, and these are maybe a bit more minor, but I think they're still important. Some of them are far more likely to protect religious minorities than religious majorities. So even though we no longer talk about Christmas break, almost every school district in the nation has a winter holiday, right? And this conveniently allows Christians to celebrate Christmas and related holidays in that season. As well, I don't know of anywhere where they hold school on Sunday. And yet sometimes a Jewish holiday, a Hindu holiday might fall on a school day. Some states have laws requiring that students be given excused absences to celebrate the religious holidays, and other states don't. So if states have those laws, they get a point. And if they don't, they get a big goose egg.
Okay. Well, Dr. Hall, give us an overview of the entire study. What did you find when you looked at religious liberty across the board?
Well, what we found is there's a wide range between the states. Illinois, the number one state in the nation, adopts 80% of the safeguards we look at. On the other hand, West Virginia has only 25% of the safeguards. So there's a huge difference between Illinois and West Virginia. Many of the states are clumped right in the middle. And one of the fun things we've been able to do since this is now in its third year is we've been able to track improvement and backsliding. And we've seen some massive improvements in states like Florida and Montana. And even though West Virginia is still in last place, they made a big jump from last year.
Well, that's good news. Now, give us a breakdown of the main categories of protection. I know that you have several there, and tell us how they relate to religious liberty in particular.
Yeah, sure. Well, again, we lump a lot of the specific items into safeguards. So we have a bunch under the healthcare provision category. And so these are protections that are aimed at ensuring that medical professionals don't have to participate in an abortion or sterilization or distribute contraception if they have religious objections to doing so. But generally, what people should be interested in is, does your state protect the ability of medical individuals and institutions from having to participate in things that they have religious objections to doing so? Also, we have a marriage and wedding category, which protects, for instance, the ability of public officials, such as a judge, to be able to decline to participate in a wedding ceremony to which he has a religious objection. One major protection we look at is states can choose to have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act or not. Currently, about 25 states have these in place, 25 don't. And this is kind of a super statute. It protects lots of areas. And so we really like to see states adopt a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Unfortunately, some states are still doing that. That's one of the reasons West Virginia, although it's still in last place, they jumped quite a bit because they adopted a Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 2023. Our study basically covers every law passed until the very end of 2023. And so if your state were to pass a Religious Freedom Restoration Act today, we wouldn't catch that in our study until Religious Liberty in the States 2025 comes out next year.
Yeah, well, this is a great study. And I would point our listeners to the website religiouslibertyinthestates.com if you want to see where your state is, religiouslibertyinthestates.com. Looking at the list, the top five, Illinois, number one, Florida, number two, Montana, number three, Arkansas, number four, Mississippi, five. And then looking at the bottom of the list, from 50th, West Virginia, 49th, Alaska, 48th, California, 47th, Vermont, 46th, Wyoming, and I'll go ahead and say 44th, New York. Honestly, in looking at this report, and you've got the breakdown of the physical map of the United States, this is breaking a lot of my preconceived ideas about where a state would fall. For example, Washington State, not known for its conservatism, is 9th in religious liberty. Whereas West Virginia is last on the list, and they border Maryland, which again borders Washington, D.C., but Maryland is 10th on the list. So what is the correlation between religious liberty and social conservatism, if there's any?
I really appreciate that question because I think Illinois gives us a very important lesson. Almost all the protections that Illinois has were adopted between 1936 and 1998. Now, today we think of Illinois as a deeply, deeply blue state. But if you recall, in the 20th century, I think Republican presidential candidates won something like 8 of 10 presidential elections in the late 20th century. The Illinois legislature was routinely controlled by Republicans, at least one house. And I think you were able to build a coalition back in the 20th century where you had maybe Roman Catholic Democrats who cared about protecting medical professionals, who were even pro-life, and they were able to make alliances with conservative rural Republicans and pass religious liberty protections back when the state was conservative. Now, what we're seeing in the 21st century is Illinois is not only not adopting new protections, they're actually trying to repeal some of those old protections. Mm. But the lesson here is that states should pass religious liberty legislation when they can't. Texas, for instance, doesn't rank nearly as well as you might think. Texas is controlled by conservatives. Texas should take this opportunity to pass religious legislation now, because maybe in 20 years it's going to be a purple state. So every state, even if you think you live in the most red of red states, don't take that for granted. Get these religious liberty protections on the books. They can be repealed, but it's a heck of a lot harder to repeal a law than to add one.
Looking overall, can you tell us if the nation as a whole is moving toward more religious protections or fewer?
I would say that there's a shift away from religious liberty. Back in the 20th century, Republicans and Democrats could come together to protect religious liberty. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a piece of federal legislation, passed 97-3 in the Senate, unanimously in the House, signed into law by President Bill Clinton. But when we get to the 21st century, basically progressives have turned their back on religious liberty, especially when it comes to things like abortion and participation in same-sex weddings. And so you see this divide. And in fact, progressives routinely talk about a freedom to worship, which might sound okay at first, but that's actually very narrow, because religious liberty protects far more than the freedom to worship. It protects our ability to act on our religious convictions in all aspects of life whenever possible. And so, yeah, I think the political left has moved away from religious liberty. And so we need to be speaking to our progressive friends and neighbors and elected officials and trying to convince them of the need to protect religious liberty for all Americans. And we emphasize that. We are not concerned with protecting religious liberty only for Christians. Mm-hmm. We believe the religious liberty of Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs and all sorts of faiths must be robustly protected. Fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court is getting a lot better on religious liberty, so that's nice to see. But again, there's still lots of room in which states can act or choose not to act, and so we're trying to shine a light on where states can act.
The website, once again, religiouslibertyinthestates.com. Now, for those who are not lawmakers or listening, how can individuals make use of this report to influence their own lawmakers?
Yeah, well, I would say certainly just contacting your local representative, local state senator, maybe point out, hey, our state doesn't do as well as it could in protecting religious liberty. You might consider proposing this statute or that statute. We actually came up with a little pamphlet for the first time this year, which we linked to on the website, Securing Religious Liberty in Your State. And what we do is we point to five pieces of model legislation, all of which are lacking in some states. And so this might be a neat little thing to send to a legislator to say, hey, you should seriously consider proposing some of these protections.
Well, again, great job on this report. It's a beautiful graphic layout of the data, and it's very intuitive, very easy to understand. ReligiousLibertyInTheStates.com. And our guest has been Dr. Mark David Hall, Director of Religious Liberty in the States and Senior Research Fellow with the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. Hall.
Thank you for having me.
Is man-made global warming going to destroy civilization? Some insist that that's the case. In fact, it's been said that climate change is more frightening than a nuclear war. What are we supposed to make of these kinds of claims? What does science really have to say about climate change, and what, if anything, can be done about it? Joining me is Dr. E. Calvin Beisner. He is founder, president, and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, a network of Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the gospel. Dr. Beisner has edited a new book with Dr. David LeGates titled Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Dr. Beisner, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
What prompted your interest in studying climate?
Gee, I could take about 10 minutes on that question alone. But I really would summarize it this way. The concerns about climate change are, I think, in some ways legitimate, in some ways exaggerated. But generally, the responses to climate change that seem to dominate in academia, in politics, in the mainstream media, are things that I think would do very, very serious harm to the poor around the world, and frankly, to everybody else, though, you know, other people could handle it better than the poor can. And I think basically that the fears are exaggerated. They're not absolutely unjustified, but they're exaggerated. And I think the best science tells us that there's a much more moderated sort of position that makes better sense.
You've read over 60 books on the science of climate change and over 30 books on the economic and engineering policies and thousands of articles on each of those. Give us a sense, if you can, of how complicated the issue of climate change is in terms of predicting what the Earth will be like in the future.
Oh, my goodness. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change actually did that for us really well back in their third assessment report in 2001. They explained that because Earth's climate is a coupled nonlinear fluid dynamic system, it is therefore impossible. That's the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's own word. It is impossible to predict future global temperature.
Hmm.
Now, despite the fact that they said that back then, they've gone ahead and tried to do that over and over again, and a lot of people outside the IPCC have tried to do it. But it is, in fact, mathematically impossible, because to do it, you would have to solve certain kinds of mathematical equations that we know are, in fact, by definition, unsolvable. So, the climate system is the most complex natural system we've ever studied, with the possible exception of human DNA and the human brain.
Okay, well, that's very helpful. It is a highly complex issue, and we're going to get into some of the ideological reasons for some of what we're seeing and hearing. But let me get back to the basic question. According to the data that's available, is the Earth getting warmer? And secondly, is man partly responsible for that?
The answer is yes, depending on what time frame you're looking at.
Okay.
If we're looking at a long enough time frame, we could actually say that even in the last 100 years or so, we've been getting cooler than it was, say, 6,000 years ago. Now, on a shorter time scale, well, let's see. From about 1350 to 1850, we had what's called the Little Ice Age. And that cooled considerably from the previous roughly 400-year period called the Medieval Warm Period. We've been coming up out of the Little Ice Age. And so we have warmed probably by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since, say, the middle of the 19th century. And we seem still to be warming right now, although, frankly, we, you know, if cooling had begun 6 months ago, we wouldn't have noticed it yet.
Okay. So we're talking about cyclical changes and not a straight line of change.
That's correct. There are cycles in solar energy output, okay, in solar magnetic wind, in mm-hmm. ocean currents, and other things that all affect global average temperature. And these cycles are of various different lengths, and they overlap each other. And so as they overlap in different ways, you wind up with different combinations and resulting in different temperatures.
In the book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, there are 16 authors, 14 climate scientists, there are energy engineers, environmental economists, and so forth. As you have talked to these scientists, what have you learned about the way that science is done when it comes to climate change as opposed to what is would be considered traditional science?
Oh, boy. Great question. First, let me talk about the way it should be done.
Okay.
And here, let me just refer to the late Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman. In a very famous video clip that you can find easily online on YouTube about what he calls the key to science, Feynman says, look, the way we try to understand how something works in nature is first we guess, then we make predictions of what we ought to observe in the natural world, whether in the laboratory or outside, if our guess is right. Then we compare what we actually observe with our predictions. And he says this, if the observations contradict the predictions, then the guess is wrong. And it doesn't matter how smart you are or how beautiful your guess is, and I would add, or how many people agree with your guess, if the observations contradict it, your guess is wrong. Now that's classic science. And by the way, that comes right out of the Bible. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, the Apostle Paul says, test all things, hold fast what is good. That's the basis of scientific method. We recognize that a rational God created an ordered universe to be understood by human beings made in his image to be rational as well. Now, the way the science is being done a great deal of the time in the climate change field is very different from that. Instead of figuring, okay, for instance, the real world observations show that warming in response to added CO2 is much smaller than what the climate models would say, we then instead question the data itself, themselves, the real world observations. And so it's been very interesting to watch as NASA and NOAA and the World Meteorological Organization and others have done some very interesting adjustments to past temperature measurements around the world. And what's curious is that those adjustments are long ago temperatures are pushed lower and recent temperatures are pushed higher, exaggerating the apparent difference, the apparent rapidity of warming. Now, if mistakes in measurements were random, and, you know, mistakes do occur, so some adjustments are understandable, but if the mistakes were random, then we would expect an equal number of upward and downward adjustments, regardless of the time period in which the mistakes occurred. But that's not what's happening. So we're clearly seeing an effort to make older temperatures look lower, newer temperatures look higher, to increase the apparent rapidity of the warming. So that's a part of the problem. Another part of the problem is, frankly, that people are saying, look, it just doesn't matter that the models are overprojecting. Eventually, it's going to come to bite us.
Okay.
And there, I think what they've done is they've just abandoned scientific method completely, and they've gone instead to fear.
That's significant, because we're not talking about science anymore. So when they say follow the science is settled, we're talking about a different form of science that really isn't science. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. In fact, I think one of the most valuable chapters in the book is chapter two, The History and Politics of, quote, Climate Change, unquote, by my co-editor, Dr. David LeGates. David, as you mentioned, is a retired professor of climatology at the University of Delaware. He's been a specialist in archiving data of all kinds about climate over lengthy periods of time. And what he argues in this chapter is, frankly, it's not about the science, and it never was. It's always been driven more by an ideology that is rooted in the anti-population growth movement, in neo-Malthusianism, the notion that because human population grows exponentially, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, et cetera, where food supplies can only grow arithmetically, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, right? We're you know, destined for famine unless we curb population growth. What the history tells us is that the anti-population growth movement, which underlies much of the environmental movement, has driven the quest to find some rationale for depriving people of the abundant, affordable, reliable energy that is absolutely indispensable to producing plenty of food for a growing population. Malthus, by the way, turned out to be wrong. Our resource supplies can actually far outgrow population, because people are not just consumers and polluters, we're also producers and stewards.
We're talking with Dr. E. Calvin Beisner. The book that we're mentioning today is Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. If we are moving away from science towards something else, what is the driving ideology that is pushing us toward what would be a worldwide an idea of how to manage humanity?
The top leaders of the world's largest environmentalist organizations over about the last 50 years or so have generally agreed that optimal human population for the world would be something on the range of, 300 to 500 million people. In other words, we need to get rid of about 95% of us.
Oh, wow.
So they see population growth as a serious threat to the health of the earth. They also tend to be either literal or at least pretty nearly literal biological egalitarians. They think that every form of life is equally valuable, has an equal right to thrive, and they think that human beings necessarily are a threat to other forms of life. Now, as a matter of fact, because God made us in his image to be creative and productive as he is, we actually can enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors, rather than detracting from them. And the more of us there are, the better we can do that. Nonetheless, most of that movement is deeply anti-Christian in its basic worldview. Part of that is rooted in a very important essay published in Science magazine in 1967 by Lynn White Jr., a medieval historian, who says that because Genesis 1:28 says that God blessed Adam and Eve and told them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over everything in it, Judaism and Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen, and that that anthropocentrism is driving the abuse of the planet. He says that verse has given Jews and Christians excuse to just rape and pillage the earth instead of being good stewards of it. Now, of course, no serious Jewish or Christian thinker has ever said so, has ever said anything remotely like that. It's a total caricature. But that essay has been reproduced in hundreds of anthologies, studied by scores of thousands of students in environmental science and environmental ethics. So that perception drives most of the environmental movement. And that in turn led to people in that looking for some way to frighten people about anything that serves the welfare of human beings so that we can have a larger population than what they think is optimal. And what that led to was figuring, okay, what enables us to feed all that many people is abundant, affordable, reliable energy, 85% of which comes from fossil fuels. So we need to condemn fossil fuels. Now, in the 50s and 60s, they were condemning fossil fuels because of particulate matter that they put into the atmosphere and carbon monoxide and sulfur oxides. And we figured out ways to remove those things so that they were not a problem. Now they turn around, and those, they said, by the way, were causing global cooling. Now they turn around and say, well, we took care of those, but now we need to condemn fossil fuels because when we burn them, we put CO2 into the atmosphere, and that warms the atmosphere, and that's a problem. And we can't pull the CO2 out so easily, so we got to quit using the fossil fuels. Now, whether fossil fuel use was driving cooling or warming, it's still condemned regardless. And that indicates that what drives it is ideology, not science.
The book is Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. It's available at cornwallalliance.org. Cornwallalliance.org. It was number one and number two on the bestseller list earlier this year. It's an incredible book if you want a basis for discussion on the concept of climate change and what man has to do with that and some of the ideology that's behind climate change. Dr. Beisner, fascinating conversation today on a very complicated topic, and it's good to have a rational, biblical view of this. Thanks for giving that to us.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Next week on The Stand Radio, Melissa Brown, founder and CEO of Safe Harbor Ohio, will tell us about their residential facility and ministry to victims of human trafficking. We'll dive into that topic and hear how the gospel is restoring lives. Today's program with Dr. Mark Hall and Dr. Calvin Beisner is available as a podcast at AFR.net. And be sure to sign up for a free 6-month trial subscription to our Stand magazine. Sign up at AFA.net/The Stand. Thanks for listening today, and join us again next week for The Stand Radio.